Welcome. Today we have with us Brad Lominick, and I think you're going to really enjoy the conversation. If you don't know Brad, you should. Brad is the author of The Catalyst Leader, Eight Essentials for Becoming a Changemaker, as well as the most recent leadership book entitled H3 Leadership, Be Humble, Stay Hungry, Always Hustle. For more than 10 years, Brad was the president of Catalyst. That is one of the largest and most influential conference movements serving young leaders. And that's where he convened literally hundreds of thousands of leaders. And he was largely responsible for what that movement became. I first met Brad when he generously offered to share that platform and let me speak on a stage. I believe it was one of his deepest life's regrets. He has more than two decades of experience working alongside thought leaders, CEOs, startup entrepreneurs. He's interviewed dozens of the world's leading thinkers. People like Malcolm Gladwell, Jim Collins, Seth Godin, Tony Dungy, Patrick Lencioni, Simon Sinek, Tony Hawk, John Wooden, Daniel Pink, and the list goes on. And so he's also been featured in Time Magazine, Fast Company, Washington Post, Fox News. So it is my privilege, my pleasure to introduce you to Brad Lominick. Brad, thanks so much for joining us.
Shane, thanks for having me, man. And yes, we did meet at Catalyst, and you crushed it both times. You got invited back.
Did I? Oh, okay. I don't remember that. But I'm sure it was a real great experience. No, it was wonderful. It was such a great experience, and you put on something that truly is unparalleled. And what are you doing nowadays? You've transitioned out of that work, and now I know lots of organizations are hiring you to consult. So tell me what you're up to now.
Yeah, I transitioned out about 4 years ago of leading Catalyst, and I actually turned 40, so it was time for me to get out of the way. Catalyst was and always should be, and hopefully always will be, led by the young, trying to gather the young. And, you know, not that I needed to get out when I was 40, but it just felt right to say, I've been leading this for a while, now it's somebody else's turn. And so I stepped out, and nobody really cared at the end of the day. I mean, it wasn't breaking news anywhere. But I decided I wanted to do some other things and really freelance and be able to be involved in lots of different movements and organizations. And, you know, as anyone knows, you know, the more you go on, you have people say, hey, why don't you come help us on this thing? And I would say, well, sorry, I can't. I got a full-time gig over here running Catalyst. And so now I get to say yes to those things. So I feel like I'm an advisor in this season. And I went from gathering thousands and building a platform to put people on that would inspire thousands to now I gather tens. Mm. And those tens hopefully are gathering thousands. So that's great. But it's not the JV team. You know, everybody kind of looks at me and goes, oh, you okay, buddy? I'm like, yeah, man, this is amazing. I just a different season, and it's still influential. It just doesn't look as sexy as the big conferences do.
Awesome. Well, you certainly learned a lot of lessons, both having led your own teams and also getting to sit at the feet of some of the great masters of leadership. I know you also worked with John Maxwell for a number of years, who's also on the TELUS Summit. So to start here, what's your moonshot? What's your big vision for positive impact? What are you trying to achieve in the world?
Well, my calling, Shane, is influence the influencers. And that's not mine only. I mean, lots of people probably felt like that was their why. But when I think about the why behind the what for me, it's influence the influencers. And I've been doing that since I was, in kindergarten. Hmm. I mean, it's been true for me. It's been my North Star for the longest time. And so, one, it gives me that gives me a lot of motivation and reason to exist and get up in the morning. But two, it also gives me some pretty wide riverbanks, but at least riverbanks to run in. And I know that's what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, whether it's doing conferences or whether it's advising leaders or whether it's working with organizations or, you know, speaking somewhere or showing up and having impact through coaching one leader, that's my reason for existence. And if I'm doing that, then I feel like I'm really achieving what I was born to do, what I'm wired to do, and hopefully what's going to leave the biggest legacy.
That's great. Thank you. So when you're thinking about business and entrepreneurship and those sorts of organizations, how do you see those being a source of solving our world's big problems?
Yeah, great question. I would say business in general and the marketplace, and this doesn't exclude nonprofits or the church or faith-based organizations or government or anything else, education. But and I think organizations and especially companies, really, because they're the lifeline and they're the fuel of revenue, they really do have a moral obligation to further the well-being of society and civilization. And that sounds like a really big statement, but I believe it's true. I actually think that in this season of where we are today, that the corporate space, the marketplace, actually is the leading indicator of the way we should operate. And at some points in history, education was, at some points in history, art was, at some points in history, government was. But I think today the lead story on what everybody's taking their cues from is the business world. A lot of people would say it's entertainment, and entertainment has a big swath, but, you know,
which is also
ultimately,
it's just,
exactly. Yeah. Ultimately, I think the business leader, the marketplace leader, the entrepreneur is the one that has the responsibility of shaping the way we do things. And that's mm-hmm. everything from how we operate, how we respond, how we're generous, what morality looks like, what greed or lack of greed looks like, what you know, collaboration, what unity looks like. So that's a big statement, but I think it's true.
So with all these people, both the people that you've gotten a chance to interact with personally, that long list of big name people that I've read off, and then of course your own experience having been a leader of organizations, could you distill down kind of your top three learnings as a leader? What you would like to kind of impart to people if you had kind of three big things, or it doesn't have to be three, but what are your big learnings from all those people you've met with and all the things you've experienced and the mistakes you've made? Not that you've made any, but...
Oh, lots of them. Well, I mean, the three phrases for me is be humble, stay hungry, always hustle, because that's the most recent book. And that's my leadership mantra, humble, hungry, hustle. I would say connected to that, the three things that I would probably distill down from the people I've been around, whether it's John Maxwell working for him or a lot of the speakers or presenters or people I've interviewed. Let me try to give you a couple. One is that they are constantly curious. Like they walk in the room with their moleskin out. And I always thought when you got to the top of the food chain, that you were, you know, you didn't really have to ask questions anymore, or you didn't have to really be that curious. You know, when you get to the top, you show up and speak, and then you just hang out in the green room and everybody comes and sort of seeks your advice. Mm-hmm. And that may be true, but I think the best leaders, the ones I've seen, you know, they show up at the conference and present, and then they're in the front row next session, hungry, looking for more, you know, with the moleskin out, like taking notes. And even if they've heard it all, you know, it's John Wooden. It's what you know it. It's what you learn after you know it all that really counts. It's just that posture that says, "I'm a sponge. I'm going to soak up everything from everybody I'm around." So that would be one.
They also curiosity and humility are connected.
No question. Yes.
Yeah.
The other one would be that sense of humility that looks like this. They walk in the room and it's not about them. And they walk in the room and they're not the center of the story. And we all know leaders who, when they walk in, they are the center of the story, whether they should be or not. And they suck the life and the oxygen out of the room. And everybody caters to them, and it's all about them, and they're the reason for existence. And I just think the great leaders I admire, they almost have this sense of humble confidence to them. Well, it is that. It's not just that or almost that. It is that. Humble confidence. They walk in, but their posture is one that says, there's a bigger story happening here. I'm part of it, and I have my role to play, but there's something more going on. And they make it about others. You know, at the end of the day, they're shifting and sort of reflecting the limelight onto other people, and not sort of off-shucksing it, but very comfortable with somebody, you know, sort of noticing them all of a sudden and saying, I can't believe you're here. Like, you're so-and-so. And they say, yeah, you know, I'm okay. I don't have to walk in and have the trumpet blown for everybody to know that I'm in the room. you know. And I just love that about leaders, again, that I admire. I give you one more, just to finish out the three, is that there is a real contentment for them on, they know their lane and they work hard in their lane, but they have a proper Sabbath and margin perspective on life. And, you know, everybody's into hustle these days. Everybody is doing their thing. And I love hustle. I mean, it's one of the three H's. But I also love the idea that the idea of margin, you know, are you as equal as much a hustler when it comes to rest and creating margin as you are to working hard? And those have to go hand in hand. You can't just redline your life forever because you're gonna blow the engine. And I find leaders that I admire are ones that they are willing to work hard when needed to work hard. There's also just this sense of that if you look at their schedule, it's like, what? Really? Like, you have that much time? You have that much margin set in? And what it is, they create margin so they can respond to opportunities put in front of them. So those would be three that immediately come to mind.
Mm-hmm. The ability to say no even when there isn't a great reason initially.
Just exactly.
Knowing,
yeah.
I have to protect this. Interesting. When you talk about always hustle, in what ways does that show up in your leadership?
Well, it definitely is the standard of excellence. And I always want to be the best in the world at what I do. So that requires a posture that says I've never arrived, and I'm also always willing to improve. And, you know, that standard keeps getting raised. And the posture that says that I'm competing against my own potential, like that's a big thing. It's not about the standard based on what you're comparing yourself to, but it's more on the standard of what your potential is. So for us at Catalyst, you know, like when we were starting out, our standard of excellence was not other conferences. It was beyond that. And if we started to compete with other conferences, then all of a sudden once we've beat them, then now we've arrived. Compared to no, like we always want to keep getting better. We always want to keep raising that standard to a next level. And it's really easy for those of us who feel like we're pretty good at something to then start to migrate down into the minimum amount possible, or to default towards, well, now we've hit it. You know, it's why everybody, once they've gotten to the top, or they've achieved what success or winning or being the best feels like, then it's hard to stay on top of that mountain. Mm-hmm. So I just say keep raising the standard, keep pushing out there to a new level of excellence. That's a big piece of it. The other piece is that you're willing to stick with something, and this is for a lot of young leaders today, and all of us, but especially younger leaders. The tendency is not to stick with it. The tendency is to jump, or the tendency is to quit, or to move on, or to leave that idea half-baked, or that initiative at the 50-yard line. And I think hustle, proper hustle, means that you execute. And if you want to figure out how to actually build credibility and be a great employee on a team and actually add value, get things done. If you move things to the finish line, if you accomplish something, if you take what your boss said and you say, you know what, like, I'm going to make this happen, you automatically become valuable. And there's a lot of organizations that they default to half-baked ideas. And you look around and go, what have we really accomplished? Like, we're just moving pieces on the puzzle compared to, no, we move things to completion. And the assignment you have, you may be the middle manager of the middle manager of the middle manager in the middle of the organization. But I promise you, if you accomplish things and execute, make things happen, push them across the finish line, finish the assignment, then your value will automatically go up in the organization.
Well, you certainly modeled it, having been kind of on the, a speaker on that stage when I went there. I had never encountered such care and attention to detail on a massive, you know, stage. It was extraordinary, whatever, 13,000 or more people in a room, and there was nothing that you guys hadn't figured out, and it was pretty extraordinary. So when you think about how the world is changing, and the theme of this is Leadership Next, of course, rapid change in the world, massive disruption technologically, generational shift, political shift, everything is changing. What is your sense? You've kind of identified, here are some basic leadership competencies that need to be in place, probably no matter what. What's your sense of what the new leadership skills that are required? Are there new leadership skills required? And for you, I want to actually focus this question specifically on leading the younger generation as they're coming out of their college and into the world, and even beyond just college. But as they're coming into the world, what new skills are required to lead them?
Well, the biggest one is that you are willing to put them in the game early. And every young leader I know, they're walking in with a premise that says, not necessarily only that I want to be in charge, but it does say that I have the knowledge in order to lead. Now, do they have the wisdom or the experience? It's questionable. But they do have the knowledge, because this is the knowledge generation. Like, we all have it, and they have it more, and they can find it faster. So the typical 20-something is walking into every organization in general and saying, I want opportunities way earlier than what you were given. And so we have to lead them in such a way that allows for that to be true. Now, you want to be smart about that, but in every situation with a young leader on your team, you need to try to give them opportunities way before they're ready. And that goes against the way you were led. Because many of us who are in our 40s or 50s or 60s, you know, we lived under the oppression of, wait your turn there, junior. Mm-hmm. You don't do anything, and you don't lead anything until you're 40. So you're just, you show up and sit around and twiddle your thumbs until it's time. But the 20-somethings today look at that and go, no, that doesn't work for me. And what happens is, if they don't have opportunities, they'll go somewhere else, because this is now the generation that says, I'll either go start my own thing, or I'll jump to the other organization. And is that bad? Not necessarily. It's just the new reality, you know. So that's a big one. That's a really big one, is put them in early, way earlier than you were given opportunities. And they're going to fail. They're going to find things that, you know, that are hard, and you want to coach them along the way. You got to let them step up. And the same is true, Shane, with the reality that a lot of 20-somethings are now leading teams of older leaders, which this is a new thing too. You know, you got the 20-something sitting in a staff meeting, looking around going, you guys are all older than me, and this is really intimidating. So what is our role in that, if we're an older leader on that team, is that you need to be their greatest coach and mentor and fan and cheerleader. Mm-hmm. And part of your role is to say, I want to help you win. Part of the 20-something's role is to look at you and say, will you please help me win? And part of the 20-something has to their posture has to be, I know I'm young. Let's all have a reality check here. I'm young. For some reason, I'm in charge. This is going to be hard, but I need you all to help me as I'm walking this journey. And just that sense of authenticity among the older and younger leader will automatically move them more towards trust, and then actually being able to work together, compared to, you know, sort of putting up our walls and saying, well, you don't know anything. And the younger person saying, well, you don't know anything. And then the gap just gets wider.
I always think in terms of what gifts this generation might be bringing us that we don't necessarily appreciate or see. And I think you've just named several. And one of them is that authenticity and that humility that is coupled with this incredible sense of the shadow side of this is entitlement, which is what often gets cast. What's the opposite of entitlement? What is that thing that there's kind of a dismissiveness and invalidation of the younger generation where you're like, wow, you got to earn that. You can't just have that. What is it in them that is a gift there?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, I think the gift there is that there is a motivation that says, I want to try this, and I want to try to actually add value way more than what you think you should give me. And if I have a team of young whippersnappers that have that posture, then that's a good thing. Now, what I have to fight out of them, or have to push out of them, or you know, sort of slap sense into them, is to say, just because you think you can change the world and that you are all that, doesn't mean that's true. And I'm going to need you to have the same level of stick-with-itness, even if you're assigned something that you don't like. This is the big piece, is that, you know, the young leaders many times will they're so focused on that sense of the why, and the sense of I got to find my sweet spot when I'm 24, and I don't want to wait. You know, I want to shortcut the process to find the ultimate expression of who I am. I mean, I love all that, but if I give you an assignment, and it's a year-long project that means that you're going to be in the shadows, are you willing to work your guts out on that when you don't get all the attention? And I need to see that as much motivation there as there is, hey, I want to be the CEO, and you know, let me come in the meeting where they, you know, in quotations, that they are actually gathering. And what's interesting, Shane, is that like our generation, and I say our because we're about the same age, you know, we were the generation before us never got in the room. Whenever the meeting was happening, they were left, you know, on the factory line or wherever. You and I got invited into the room wherever they were gathering, the board meeting, the important people, but we had to sit in the corner and not say anything. And we could just say, well, we were in there, but we didn't get to participate. 20 somethings right now, Gen Y and Gen Z, millennials and Z generation, both, they expect to not only be in the room, but actually be sitting at the table and participating, like contributing to the conversation. So if you just take those three different models of the generation earlier than us, you know, older than us, never got in. We got in, but we had to sit in the corner. Now the young generation says, I'm in the room, I'm at the table, and I'm actually participating. That's three major differences in scenarios of how they want to operate. So that's where we are today.
And you alluded to some of this in what you just said, which is you needed to help them understand there's got to be some stick-to-itiveness. So we've talked about some of the gifts. What are some of those seemingly inborn or innate limits of this emerging generation that we need to help them grow through? There's a lot we need to learn from them in, and then there's probably some things we can help them grow through. What are some of those things that they need to help growing in?
I think definitely failure and being okay with failure, being not only okay with it, but it actually like leaning into it and allowing themselves not just to fail, but to learn from it and then keep getting better. But also that one failure doesn't mean the end of your existence.
Do you find they're a little less resilient to failure? Do you find they kind of turn away from it more so than another generation? I mean, to some extent, everybody wants to avoid it, but is your sense that there's a little bit more sensitivity in this next generation?
Yes, no question. To both of those, the answer is yes. I mean, I heard somebody the other day telling me, and I don't remember what company it was, but it was a well-known organization, that they are hiring praise officers. Like, this is a Fortune 100 company, and they're hiring praise officers or praise consultants who come in and actually are, you know, are creating ego biscuits for their staff. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? I mean, we're outsourcing praise and celebration. And
that's my next hire, you know, for me. I just need one.
There you go.
I'm just going to hire someone.
Yeah, we all need that, right? I just want somebody around me constantly praising me. But
wow.
That, okay. I think that's a sign,
it.
Man.
Yeah, that really
that's
is.
A sign.
I've done
a little bit of work with some colleges and some athletic programs and just trying to help them understand these gaps and differences in generations. And one of the things that I hear a lot from college coaches is that they're really having a hard time with the student athlete today dealing with failure, because everything in their life has been built on you're the best. You know, they've never lost. They've never had any setbacks in their life. And so all of a sudden they get to that level, Division I level in college, in any sport, and the ability to fail and then learn from it and to be resilient, as you said, and not to see this as, oh my gosh, my life is over now, but actually, no, this is just part of the process. This is part of the journey that we're going on, and they're having to coach them and actually teach them what that looks like.
And implied in that is the need for those of us that are leaders of that emerging generation to be comfortable in our own failure, our capacity to, I presume, reframe for them, right? That we can't expect them to just know how to do that. That's our responsibility.
I think it's part of our responsibility, and it's also modeling it, and it's also saying, hey, listen, I'm going to give you things, I'm going to give you opportunities before you're ready, and you need to understand you will fail, and it's okay. Like, we're going to get through it. I'm going to coach you through it. But if you want the responsibility early, you have to deal with then the reality that you're going to have some setbacks, and not everything is going to be 100%. Not everything's going to be the A+. You're not going to crush it every time, but that's just part of the journey. And you know, we're okay with that. And if we look at the organizations that are most innovative and the ones we admire the most, I mean, all the articles, all the data, all the best practices coming out of the organizations that seem to be thriving, especially gathering and putting young leaders in place and having a culture that's healthy, they all talk about this, the idea that they're teaching their employees and their staff what failure is and isn't. And it's okay not to be a failure, but to actually like risk and be so willing to get out there on the end of the diving board that you end up, you know, doing a backbuster. You may try to do that 3.5 gainer, but man, every fifth time you're gonna slap that back pretty hard and get back in the water, you know, get back on the diving board and keep trying and, you know, keep getting better.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to some practical stuff here. You know, built into a great team is both diversity and high octane people. Without diversity, you don't have the resources you need to solve a problem. Without high octane, you don't have the strength. But of course, built into diversity and high octane is potentially lack of buy-in and lack of alignment. You've worked with a lot of high-powered people. How do you get diverse, high-powered people pulling in the same direction?
Well, I think you got to tune the piano all to the same fork, right? I mean, that's vision. That's mission, vision, values. And those are the underlying components there. And as long as everybody's moving towards something that everybody is seeing as the North Star, then that's the way that organizations thrive. The challenge is that, you know, when you start tuning the piano with different tuning forks, then all of a sudden everybody's tuning to a different melody. Or I don't know the right way to describe that in, because I'm not a musician, but you know, we have lots of organizations.
Dissonance.
There you go. That's exactly right. Yeah. So it doesn't mean that we don't bring different expressions, but we all have to be tuned to the same one fork. And, you know, lots of times there are differing visions, and there's differing missions, and there's differing phrases, and there's a sense of, well, what are we moving in the same direction? We're not sure, because lots of different messages are being put out there, you know. So I think the job of a leader at any level, not just at the highest level, but at any level, is to create consistency around that message that keeps flowing down. And you know you've got it when the person at the furthest levels away from the nuclear core can actually repeat what that is.
How do you get the person furthest away from the core to be able to repeat that?
That ultimately it's got to be repeated at every level then. And everybody, there's something that is there that drives down and keeps getting repeated, and the message is the same throughout. You know, Chick-fil-A is a great example. I mean, why is every Chick-fil-A in the country, when you go through the drive-thru, and this is not a vision statement, but it is a reflection of values. Mm-hmm. When you go through the drive-thru, they don't say, "You're welcome." They say, "My pleasure." Mm-hmm. Well, how did that happen? Well, it's because it got driven down through the organization, the furthest levels away from the nuclear core. And that was intentional over time, you know, that occurred. And the same is true with vision. It's got to be repeated. It's got to be validated. It's got to be reflected at every level, you know. So if you're in the middle of the organization, part of your job is to validate and repeat, because all the people at lower levels are looking at you. they hear the CEO say it, but they look at you and go, is this true? Is this actually believable?
Yeah.
Because if Betty's not doing it and she's a VP, then I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm a director.
How do you lower the risk of a bad hire?
Wow, good question. We always said this. I mean, my days at Catalyst, like our motto was we don't hire anyone, we intern them. And we wanted to see them operate in our world way before we ever said yes to them getting on the team full time. And we did. I mean, even if it was a high level person, we would say, you got to come work an event with us. We'll pay you. Like, we'll pay you what we would somebody who we just, you know, had on a retainer or contracted. But we want to see you operate in our environment. And I know that's not possible for everybody, because there are some organizations, you know, they're hiring hundreds of people each day. But I would say, whenever possible, put them into as much of the scenario that they're going to need to be in way before you ever say yes to them. That would be my advice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to hear their story too. That for me is so important in regards to hiring. Is I don't want to know what you've done. I want to know who you are. I don't want to just know how you did it. And that is important, but I want to know the identity of you, the character, the pieces below the surface. I want to know, you know, what makes you tick. I want to see all the story. And it's so easy to just give the highlight reel on a resume or in that mm-hmm. interview. People can interview really well, and there's coaches who help them. But, you know, I want to see as much of the full story as possible. So that would be that's my philosophy. I go really slow, and I always advise people go really slow when you're hiring, even if it means you might miss out on somebody. Ultimately, if there's a bad hire, it's your fault. If you hired fast, and if you just found a warm body to put in place.
So I'm going to end with a question about what advice you have about how to terminate team members. Before we get to that, though, because that's a juicy one, and I think most people need to learn it, what's a good way for people to get in touch with you or get resources? I know you've got something for them. What have you got for our listeners if they wanted to learn more from you?
Sure. Just my first and last name, Brad Lominick, Lominick. So bradlominick.com. And if they go to my website, they can sign up for a free newsletter. I'm going to send them a great little PDF on leading the next generation.
Great.
But I'm also at all the social media outlets at that same name, first and last name. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I lucked out and had a name that I don't think anybody else in the world owns. So
yeah, me
well
too.
Done for me, right?
Yeah. I've got the last name with a body part. Great. Okay. So what advice do you have about terminating team members, transitioning them out of a team?
Gosh, it's hard. I mean, the first thing is this, your job, if this is on your plate, is to help them thrive and see the best and believe the best and move them towards the best possible for them. Even if they've been an awful employee and this is just not going well, the posture and the mindset that says, I want to help you win, always is helpful when transitioning people or terminating people or removing them. That's the first thing. The second thing is make it quick. My gosh. Hire slow, fire fast. Hire slow, fire fast. If they're not a good fit and you've done all the due diligence needed, let's move them on to a place where they can thrive. And that's, for me, always been true, is if they're not working in our culture, in our environment, in that role, I want to find the place for them to thrive the most. And that's always my approach when having to let somebody go or to move them on, is to say, let's find the best for you. Like, if this is a bad fit, it doesn't make you a bad person. It just means it's a bad fit. So you're not awful.
Let me clarify something. When you say fire fast, do you mean come to a decision quickly, or do you mean walk in and say you're gone as quickly as possible?
The former. Come to a decision quickly. Okay. Because most of the time, everybody on the team, if you walk in and do an assessment of many teams, everybody on the team will always have the same name in mind. If you ask the question, hey, who on the team here doesn't fit? Mm-hmm. Who, if we're voting somebody off the island, who should go first? Mm-hmm. Everybody has, says the same name. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, you know, most of us as leaders, we go, well, you know, we want to give them a chance and we want to have a culture that is empowering. And that, again, all that may be true. But if you know the situation warrants that somebody's not a good fit, that they're sticking around and not, they're now slowing down the team. You know, they are dragging everybody else down. They're a bad, toxic part of the culture. They're, all those pieces are in place, then you need to move quickly to make that transition happen. And we tend, because we're naturally, as humans, we dislike confrontation, especially when it's our, when it's up to us. You know, we don't like to feel like we're having to tell someone what they don't want to hear. And I just look at it just the opposite, is I'm actually freeing you up to go do something that you're great at in an environment where you can thrive. And for some reason, it's not working here, but we love you and we're going to release you and we're going to believe the best in you. And we want you to go on and do great things. And we all know this is true. Like, a lot of times when people leave, the way they leave says more about you as a leader and your organization than the way they actually participated when they were there. So, mm-hmm. You know, I want to believe the best. I want to provide as much as possible for them. I want them to walk away and go, you know what, that 2 years there didn't work out, but man, the way they transitioned me, I feel really valued, and I feel like I've been emboldened to this next season of life. That's what I want people to say when they leave my team.
Brad, it has been a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know this has added value to our listeners, and we look forward to seeing big things from you in the future. Again, if you want to get more from Brad Lominick, you can go to his website, bradlominick.com. Make sure you opt in for that free gift and learn about how to lead the next generation. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thanks, Shane. You're the best, man.